It's time now for Super Psychologist, Dr. Mara Karpel, and your golden years.
Good evening and welcome to Dr. Mara Karpel and your golden years this evening and every Sunday evening, 5 p.m. Central Time, that's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com and on drmarakarpel.com. And you can hear this show again by going to my website, drmarakarpel.com, that's drmarakarpel.com. And the link to the podcast along with the link to all the websites spoken about by my guests on the show will be posted later tonight or early tomorrow morning. And you can hear the podcast as soon as 5 minutes after the show ends by going directly to blogtalkradio.com. That's blogtalkradio.com/yourgoldenyears. And for information about previous shows and upcoming shows, again, go to my website, drmarakarpel.com. Go to blogtalkradio.com/yourgoldenyears. And follow me on Facebook, Dr. Mara Karpel, Your Golden Years. Want to contact me? You can email me at drmara, D-R-M-A-R-A, at drmarakarpel.com, drmarakarpel.com, or you could go through my website or give me a call at 512-626-6973. This evening's program was produced by Compass Entertainment Postal Productions and Psyched Up, sponsored by Dr. Ronald DeVere, neurologist, memory specialist, and author of the book, Memory Loss, Everything You Want to Know But Forget to Ask. To make an appointment with Dr. DeVere at his memory clinic in Lakeway, Texas, or to purchase a copy of his book, you can call him at 512-261-7909, or you can email him at rdevere, that's R-D-E-V-E-R-E, at austin.rr.com, and his book is also available on Amazon. This show is also sponsored by the bra lady, Sonia Das, helping every woman have a perky day. In Austin, call Sonia at 512-898-9058 or go to haveaperkyday.com. This evening's program is also sponsored by Storyhouse. Storyhouse gathers your stories and turns them into multimedia collections that can be shared now and for generations to come. Have Storyhouse over to conduct a private interview in your home or invite them to your next big event or family reunion. Storyhouse, where your memories live. Find out more at yourstoryhouse.com or call 512-296-8752. And today is Sunday, April the 10th, and we are back live in beautiful Austin, Texas, and the weather is nice and warm here after my time in New York where it got pretty chilly last week. And this evening, Art Mendoza of Accomplice Entertainment, producer of the show, is with us to do the production engineering for the show. And he will be answering your calls if you call later with questions for me or my guests. So feel free to give a call with your questions and be sure to say hi to Art. And if this is the first time that you're tuning in, I'm a licensed psychologist from New York City, practicing here in Austin, Texas, and the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. And I work with adults of all ages and have a specialty of working with seniors and caregivers. And for the past few years, I've also been evaluating veterans for PTSD. And most recently, my office has been in the wonderful Veterans Resource Center, Heroes Night Out in Cedar Park, Texas. And for information about this really great resource for veterans and for their families, you can check out their website at heroesnightout.org. All right, so this evening we have a full lineup again. First, we'll be speaking with Megan Devine, who is a clinical mental health therapist, and she has been a therapist for over 15 years, and she is the founder of Refuge in Grief, which is meant to provide emotionally intelligent grief support for people on the journey of grief, having lost someone close to them. So we're going to talk about what is emotionally intelligent grief support. And then later in the show, I'll be speaking with musician, early childhood educator, and children's book author Rochelle Rabone about her music and about bringing the music of Africa to children. And I will also be talking about controlling our inner troll and how changing our own talk changes how we feel. And throughout this evening's program, I will have time to take your questions. So if you have questions for me or for my guests, please feel free to give a call. The toll-free number is 855-345-4720. That's 855-345-4720. Or you can email or tweet your questions to me, and I will read them on the air to my guests. And my email again is drmara, D-R-M-A-R-A, @ DrMaraKarpel.com, DrMaraKarpel.com, and my Twitter address is MaraEK. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, and after the break, the founder of Refuge in Grief, Megan Devine, joins us to talk about emotionally intelligent grief support. So don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Super Psychologist Dr. Mara Karpel will be back after words from our sponsors.
Worried about memory loss? Dr. Ronald DeVere, certified neurologist and director of Alzheimer's disease and memory disorders in Lakeway, has been helping those with dementia and memory loss for over 12 years, specializing in the diagnosis, treatment, and counseling of those with memory loss and dementia. Dr. DeVere also has a book to reduce your worry and fear by knowing the facts. Memory loss, everything you want to know but forget to ask, available now on Amazon.com. Dr. Ronald DeVere, Alzheimer's disease and memory disorders center in Lakeway, and his book, Memory Loss, everything you want to know but forget to ask. For more information or to schedule an appointment, call 512-261-7909.
If you despise bra shopping in the stores, have a complimentary bra fitting at your home or office. It's so convenient. And with 13 styles, including a no-wire bra and 52 sizes A through H cup, Sonia Das, the bra lady, has the bra that's just right for you. What are you waiting for? Call to schedule your personal fitting today and find out what all the ladies love about essential bodywear. Call 512-981-8788 or preview the products at haveaperkyday.com and have a perky day. Gravity.
Are you or a loved one a Medicare beneficiary? Help save you and Medicare money by stopping Medicare fraud. Fraud happens when Medicare is billed for services or supplies you never receive. There are three easy things you can do to fight fraud. Review your Medicare claims for accuracy, protect your personal information, and be on the lookout for suspicious activity. For more information or to report fraud, call Medicare at 1-800-MEDICARE or your local SHIP counselor at the Area Agency on Aging at 1-800-252-9240.
Please visit us on the web at www.drmaracarpel.com.
And we're back. If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Mara Karpel in your golden years on Blog Talk Radio and on live stream and podcast at drmarakarpel.com. And now joining me on the phone, therapist and founder of Refuge in Grief, Megan Devine, joins us to talk about emotionally intelligent grief support. And if you have questions, feel free to give a call at 855-345-4720 or send your question to me at Dr. Mara at drmarakarpel.com to M-A-R-A-E-K. Welcome, Megan. Are you there?
I am.
Just to let you know, when we talk like this, there's a slight delay.
Okay.
Okay. So thank you so much for joining me this evening. I know that when I wrote to you, I told you that I had come across your website after I had lost my father last fall, and I really appreciated the things that you wrote about on your website.
Thank you. I'm really glad that it was useful for you. That's one of my favorite things to hear from people, that they've found themselves in grief, and that something that I've said has helped.
I'm sure. So Megan, before we get into more of the discussion about, the refuge and grief, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I've been a clinical psychotherapist for 16 or 17 years, I think. I sometimes lose count. And I was in private practice for many years and was actually thinking about getting out of practice so that I could be outside and moving and doing more things with my hands. And so I was in the middle of that transition, leaving psychotherapy, when my partner drowned. Sometimes I say died accidentally, but today we're going to say that he drowned. It was a beautiful, ordinary, fine summer day, and we went out for a swim. And that was an amazing athlete, incredibly skilled in the woods and the water. So there was no concern ever for us that he would get into a body of water and not be able to get out. So the day that he died, I quit my psychotherapy practice. And I tried to stay away. I really, really did. But when Matt died, what I found for grief support for me, being a really young widowed person, I was 38 at the time when Matt died, and the resources available at that time, so we're talking 2009, so almost 7 years ago, were really non-existent, or what was there just didn't work for me. And so as I moved through my own grief, I'm a writer, I've been a writer my whole life, I started writing about what I was finding and what would really be useful for me and what bothered me about the state of grief support. And so about 3 years after Matt died, I started building my business around that to really reach out to people who were just like me, for whom traditional grief support was really failing miserably. I couldn't let those people be in that kind of pain alone and find what I found. So I came back and created Refuge in Grief, to be that resource that I couldn't find for myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know that Refuge in Grief offers a lot of different types of grief support. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy the blog, but I know that there's more to what you do.
There is, yeah. The blog is currently my most the thing that happens the most regularly right now is the blog and the weekly letter that comes out, where I usually talk about some aspect of living with grief, whether you're in early grief or you've been living in it for a while. And then there's also the Writing Your Grief course, which is super popular, and I'm so proud of this course. A student of mine asked me about 2.5 years ago now if I would, she said, what I really want is to sit down with other writers and write the story of what happened to me and what happened to my family. So this student of mine had a very late term, it's not a miscarriage then, it's a stillbirth. Her son died in utero just a few days before his due date, and she had been writing through that and just said, I can't go to a regular writing group because I'm talking about a dead baby. And you can't just bring that into a Sunday morning meetup for tea. And so I said, I can make you that. I can create that for you. So I created the Writing Your Grief course for one particular person, and it's really blossomed into this beautiful network and community of support where people who are carrying any kind of grief come together, and it's one of the rare places where we can tell the truth about our experience without anybody jumping in to correct it or talk us out of it or put a smiley face on it or try to make it better than it is. And that's really what I hear from my writers and my students. It's, the first couple of days of a writing course there, and they're saying, oh, my gosh, I am so glad to be here. Like, it is such a relief to be able to tell the truth. So the Writing Your Grief courses are something that I'm really, really proud of, and it did come out of a need that somebody brought to me. And it was a way I could answer that need and make that community. So Reading Your Grief courses happen roughly every 6 to 8 weeks. So there's almost always one coming up, and information about that is on the website.
Great. One of the things that I really appreciated when I was reading your blogs and your letters was the whole idea that grief is not time limited, and people often tell you you should be over it by now after a period of time, and you're, you know, you're writing about how that's just not true, was pretty powerful for me.
Mm. Yeah, I think we've got this weird cultural disconnect around grief. It's something that we don't actually talk about. We'll talk about death, we'll talk about sex, but we won't talk about grief. And it's so bizarre to me because it's something so personal and so intimate and something that we're all going to experience at some time. But we've got these wholly incorrect and not helpful ideas about what grief looks like. We have this belief that we've inherited somewhere in our culture that says that grief ends and that you'll get over it eventually. And, you know, if you do it correctly, you'll come back even better and stronger than you were before. And honestly, that is so offensive. It's offensive
right.
to somebody in pain, right? That
like
somehow you needed
correct,
this.
Yeah. Like there's a correct way.
Yeah, there's a correct way, which, you know, the second half of that idea that there's a correct way says that you can fail at this.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to add that kind of performance pressure onto somebody whose heart just got broken. And that's cruel, right? There's,
mm-hmm.
there's no correct way to do grief, and there's no timeline for grief. I remember, you know, even before my experience with Matt's death, I remember talking to older people who I knew, you know, were in their 70s or their early 80s, and they still remembered, and their eyes would still well up, and their voices would still crack when they talked about a child that they lost 65 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't stop loving somebody just because their physical body is no longer with us. So if we don't expect love to end, why would we expect grief to end? It's ridiculous.
Right.
So,
right.
you know, a lot of what I do is I think of what I do is actually very simple. I tell the truth about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it
mm-hmm.
seems like, well, duh, but it's not, well, duh, because we have all of these myths and all of these stories that we tell each other about grief, even though we know that inside ourselves those stories don't match. So we need to start telling the true stories about grief.
So, you know, do you have advice, and you might have written about this, and I don't remember mm-hmm. if I've seen it, but do you have advice for people who come across others who say things that maybe are just not sensitive, or
yeah.
I know a lot of, or even advice for people who don't know what to say to somebody who's
yeah.
in grief, rather than saying things like, oh, they're in a better place, which...
Mm-hmm.
Usually that's not
yeah.
helpful.
It's tricky. And one of the things, so I, you know, as I said, I try to tell the truth as much as I can about grief and call things what they are. And one of the complaints that I get from some people is, you know, I'll say like, what we say to each other inside grief is not helpful. You know, saying everything happens for a reason, or they wouldn't want you to be sad. If I come out and I say like, those things are so not helpful, I'll get some pushback very often that says, well, people's hearts are in the right place. They mean well. I know that they do. But if your goal there, if what you're trying to do is support and care for someone you love who's in pain, then you need to be able to hear that what you're doing isn't working. You're not getting what you most want, which is to love and care for somebody who's in pain. If you want to do that, you need to be willing to hear what doesn't help. And be willing
mm-hmm.
to do the hard and interesting and sometimes scary work of being vulnerable and saying, like, there is nothing I can say here. Your presence and your willingness to acknowledge how bad something is or how painful something is, that's an amazing gift that you can give somebody. I mean, the cool thing is because grief isn't something that needs to be fixed, you can stop working so hard to fix it. That's awesome.
Right.
Right. I think,
right.
I think as witnesses, as people who are watching somebody we love be in grief or in pain, we have this sort of like freak out tension with like, oh, I have to take this away. I have to make this better. Like they're in pain. I need to fix it. Of course we get all stressed out and we stumble over our words because our goal is not something that even with the best of skills we can achieve.
Mm-hmm.
But when we start looking at people we love who are in pain and don't see them as something to be fixed, but instead as something to be supported and someone to be acknowledged, our jobs become much more simple. And simple is not easy. This is actually a very difficult thing to do because it's not what our culture tells us to do. So instead of like coming to somebody and seeing them in pain and, you know, trying to take their pain away from them is not going to make them feel better. And that's what we're doing when we're saying they're in a better place or they wouldn't want you to be sad. We're trying to make their pain go away. And for the grieving person, that actually comes across as very dismissive and rude. And it makes us as grieving people stop talking to you, because if every time we say, I hurt, you say, it's not that bad, why should we keep talking?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole lot of things to shift and change in here. So one, if you're the person trying to be of support and of use, keep your eyes on your goal. Your goal is not to fix their pain, but to acknowledge their pain and to be there with them and to be one of those wonderful people who we can come to with the reality of pain and not feel like we have to hide it or defend it. So you can come in and you can say, you know, there is nothing I can do to fix this, and I'm here and I'm with you, and however I can make the world around you more comfortable so that all you have to deal with is your grief, I'm here to do that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that means doing like the physical, tangible things like go to the store and get groceries for them or walk the dog for them or, you know, whatever you can do so that their load is lessened,
mm-hmm.
so that they can turn more of their attention to their own hearts. That's a beautiful thing to do. And then your other question there, Mara, was, you know, if you're the grieving person and you're receiving basically all this judgment on your grief, because as grieving people, especially, I have this theory that I haven't scientifically tested, but my theory is that the more unusual the death or out of order or not in what we think of as the natural order of things or the more traumatic, basically the more random the death you're grieving or the life that you're grieving, the more judgment comes out to you because it's scarier for those of us who are watching, right?
Mm, that's interesting.
Somebody who's hit, you know, by the bus coming home from work on an ordinary day, what we come in with was, were they not looking both ways across the street? Were they texting while they were doing that? What were they doing?
Right.
Basically, what were they doing wrong? I won't do those things, therefore I'm safe. So if you're the
mm-hmm.
partner or the parent or the close friend or the sibling of the person who got hit by the bus, we come in and we say, you know, oh, well, there's, you know, they shouldn't have been doing this anyway. So, you know, we just do this weird thing with grief. So if you're the grieving person and you're experiencing judgment in the costume of comfort from other people, one of the things that you can do is say, you're going to be a broken record here, but to say the same thing over and over, what you're saying right now is not helpful and I need you to stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Or something like, what I need from you right now is to support me, not try to make me better.
Right.
And honestly, there are some people who can't do that, who cannot not fix you. Right. It's okay
right.
to say to
mm-hmm.
those people, I'm not going to discuss this with you right now. Goodbye. Right. You can
right.
walk away or you can distance yourself from those folks. It doesn't mean that we hate them and they're terrible and they're doing awful things. It means that right now your heart is too tender. It's like you don't have the buffer to be able to withstand long conversations where you need to defend your grief. Just take yourself out of those situations
right.
to the best of your ability.
Some people
it's worth your limited energy to help to redirect and to reeducate, and some people it's just simply not. And of course we can do that with kindness and understanding that they're trying to be of service. But I hate to see grieving people use what little energy they have to continually defend their grief to people who cannot and will not hear it.
Mhm. Mhm. So, you know, there may be people who just don't know what the right thing is to say.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Any kind of direction is helpful to them.
Yeah.
Because they
yeah.
really want to be there. And then there are people like you said who just can't help but try to fix it because it's too uncomfortable mm-hmm. for them to be around somebody who's in grief. So the best thing to do is just not be around them.
Yeah, I mean, some of those relationships we can't help but be around. But again, so there is an article that I'd written about this, and I can't remember the title of it right now, but it's one of my Huffington Post pieces about how to deal with judgment on your grieving process. In fact, it might even be called that. And there's a script in there that's really useful to follow. You know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. You can, you know, find sort of stock phrases to redirect people. What was one of mine? Gosh, in my I have sort of a haze around my early grief because that's what happens, you know, as you sort of live forward those early days of impact, things get a little bit hazy.
Sure.
And I can't remember what I used to say, but I know that I had a stock phrase, and one of my close friends, very insightful person, said, "I know that when you say this phrase, you have stopped listening to me because I have stopped being useful."
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember what phrase it was, but I was like, exactly.
Right.
So that's like, this is what can happen. You know, we're like, God, I can't correct you anymore. I can't fight this anymore. I can't continue to point out how not useful what you're saying is. But yeah, this is the thing to remember also is that none of this is easy.
Mm-hmm.
Being the person in pain is not easy. Being the one trying to support the person in pain is not easy. All of this is difficult.
Right.
So we've all got to sort of cut ourselves some slack. And one of the things that I remember very clearly from my own early grief is that no one could win, right? If my friends didn't call to check in on me, I felt like they were abandoning me. If they did call to check in on me, they were interrupting me, right?
Uh-huh,
so no one can win. You know, this isn't a solvable dilemma. This is hard. Right, and we want to take care of ourselves and take care of each other as best we can, and especially for the supporting cast, the people in your life who truly do have their hearts in the right place and want to be there for you. This is a work in progress, right, and we're all practicing. And what we can do, I think the easiest thing to remember, I think, you know, I very often get questions from people like, give me a list of things I can say. Well, I can't give you a list of things you can say, but I can give you one thing to remember. And the important thing to remember is that this isn't something to be fixed. It's something to be supported. And if you remember that and you use that as your compass, you're going to find that you almost immediately have more skill because you're standing on the right foundation.
Right.
Right? When we stop trying to fix it, we can relax. So, you know, there is no list of things to say, although I do have a list of more useful things to do and say for grieving people. Also on the Huffington Post. But, That's the takeaway there is remember that this isn't something to be fixed. It's something to be acknowledged and supported. And if you keep yourself pointed there, you'll be fine.
And I think what you said earlier about being honest is really important. And I think you can be honest and say this is really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, and I love that. I mean, this is the same thing when we do public speaking, right? If you come up and you say, I'm really nervous, you get less nervous. So
right.
If you're nervous about, I don't know what to say, it's okay to say, this is really hard. I have no idea what to say to you. And I'm here, and I'm willing to stumble on myself in order to show up with all of my love for you and all of my support. It's like we love each other enough to feel incapable, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I know what I found, you know, for myself was that the best thing that anybody could say to me was, I'm sorry, or is there anything I can do? Just like you said, you know, people coming to your aid to take care of things. That was really probably the most appreciated, those were the most appreciated things for me.
Yeah.
For me personally.
And those are things that are meant to offer tangible support rather than talk you out of your pain. They were supporting your pain. And a couple of things I want to say about, a few things I want to say, I always have things to say. Grief is really individual, just as love and relationship and whomever or whatever you've lost was individual. So for you, you just said, Maura, that people saying I'm sorry for your loss was really helpful and people asking you what you could do was really helpful. For other people, that question of, you know, what can I do for you or call me if you need anything actually adds an extra burden, especially in early grief, right?
Mm-hmm.
So instead to come in and say, you know, the thing is, you know, early grief, you don't have a lot of energy. You don't have a lot of brain space. So to be able to think of something that you might need and then have the energy to call somebody and ask for that is beyond the capacity of a lot of people. So a better question or a better statement might be, I'm going to show up at your house versus, you know, call me if you need some help, right? So, again, we want to make it easier on the grieving person and try to the best of our ability to not give them extra steps. And asking somebody who's in pain to call you and ask for help is an extra step. So basically same support, same message, but making it just a tiny bit easier.
Right.
And you said, you know, hearing I'm sorry was really useful for you. It is really useful for some people. Other people don't find that useful. So I'm a really big fan of consent across all areas of life. So if you're not sure something is helpful for somebody, you can ask. They may not have the energy or the capacity at that time to answer you, but you can always ask. You can come in and say, you know, my temptation here is to say, I'm so sorry. And I wonder if that's helpful for you, if that means anything for you, or does that drive you nuts? And so being willing to be uncomfortable, being willing to not know that we love each other enough to fumble, that's powerful.
Right?
And again, it's easier, right, because you don't have to know how to do this. None of us know how to do this. It's all a work in progress. Figure it out as we
go
along. Asking is one way we can really hone and make sure to the best we can that our support is actually landing the way that we hope it does, the way that we want it to. And really the only way we know that is to ask.
That's a good point. That's a good point. So, you know, one of the letters that you wrote, and I believe it's also a blog, was about how to start to, not feel better in the way that, you know, people want you to feel better, but actually to be able to go on living without having constant pain. And, you know, you talk about how the usual tools don't really apply to grief. So what does seem to help?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I do write about that a lot, and I talk about that a lot. There's an audio book on my site called Everything Is Not Okay, and I really go into depth about what things help and what does help even mean, right? I mean, just as you said, like, you're not going to get better in the way that maybe our culture thinks you would or that the people around you think you should, right? Because better is like an improvement, and how does this improve? The person you lost is not going to come back. So we have to think of new ways to describe what does continuing to live look like. And I think if we take away that you'll come back bigger, better, stronger, more resilient, knowing what's important, if we take that out of the equation, then we can start asking the question of, like, given that I'm still here, how can I live here in a way that feels true for me, that feels real for me? That doesn't mean that, like, how can I live so that I can be happy and transform this? No. What we're talking about in terms of quote-unquote better is, how can I live a life that is in integrity and alignment with me and who I am and what this person meant to me and continues to mean to me? How do I live forward carrying this with me? And what helps for you is going to be whatever helps you access that place in you, and we all have it, that place in you where you don't feel better, but you feel righted. And righted is sort of a soft term, but like I think we know it when we feel it, right? That you feel different. You feel like you can carry the load of this loss in a way that's a little bit more gentle. And the things that help me do that personally, and again, you know, your mileage may vary here, but the things that help me do that are usually being out in the woods or being in the garden, or I'm newly a gigantic fan of tango, so tango helps me. Anything that like gets me into my body and not into my mind or out of my mind is useful for me. And being around people with whom I can have deep conversations that are meaningful to me. Like, these are the things now to this day, and also, you know, in my life before Matt died and in the early days of grief, like the things that helped me access that place in myself before he died are still the same things that help me access it now. And that helped me access, although it was more difficult, in those early days of grief. A lot of people find that that place of stillness when they're outside in nature, something that's larger than you. There are landscapes that can contain the pain you're in when you feel like your own body can't contain it, right? So moving forward in grief, or living well in grief, is about finding those places where you feel companioned, where you feel rooted. And that's different than looking for the places where you feel happy, or how do you build a life that's happy. I don't think that's a fair thing to do to anybody, not just in grief, but in general, because happiness is transitory and circumstantial. And what we're really talking about is, how do I best companion myself and live out what I have of this life for however long I have it in a way that feels beautiful and useful for me?
Mm-hmm.
So looking for those things, those relationships, those people, those practices, anything that helps you sort of be that deeper self is what's going to help you through this, right? I mean, that's sort of a non-answer to your
mm-hmm.
question, but it's the best answer that I have, because again,
right,
every person is unique, and you're going to find your own way through this by listening to yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly take
mm-hmm.
guidance from outside sources where those outside sources feel useful for you. I use useful a lot because that's a great term for me, but this really becomes listening to yourself. And where do I want to grow, and how do I want to change, and how do I want to carry this, and where do I weave this into my life? And I think living forward in grief is about integrating who this loss has made you become, because things like this change us. Not better, not
mm-hmm.
worse, just different, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we do have some choice in how we cultivate this new person we're becoming. Yeah,
right.
that's really how I see that trajectory of building a life. We never go back to who we were. That's just not possible. But we're
mm-hmm.
still here, and we're becoming somebody different, and we only learn that or find ways to do that by experimenting and by listening.
Yeah. So do you find that it's helpful when people actually, sit and think about what they got from the relationship that they were in, and being able to foster some of those things so that, that person kind of lives on in a way?
Sure. There's a distinction that I want to make here. When you choose to do something like that because you choose it, it can be very, very powerful. When somebody from
mm-hmm.
outside of your grief tells you you should do that, it doesn't always land very well. Right. None of
right.
us like being told what to do. So I would use some caution there. I don't want anybody to go around and say, hey, you should really reflect on blah, 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 unless you're the person's therapist and they've asked you. Not so much.
Mm-hmm.
But to do that as a practice for yourself, it can be useful. Some people find I have a lot of people in my world who were widowed quite young, as I was, and some of them actually found that they, without trying to, without knowing it was happening or realizing it was happening, like took on some of the characteristics and the traits and the habits and practices of their partners who had died. I remember, as I said, Matt was a fantastic athlete and incredibly strong, and I found myself able to do some arm balances in yoga randomly that I couldn't do before, and I was like, oh, I absorbed some of his strength and his skills. Now, whether
mm-hmm.
that's accurate or not, who knows, but I do, in any relationship, we change each other, don't we? And why should that be any
Absolutely.
Different? And the, again, just because the physical body is gone doesn't mean our relationship ended. We are still relating.
Mm-hmm.
Not the same, and that's not meant to take it away. Right, but we are still relating, so that relationship should still be changing you. It
right.
continues to happen. Yeah, and this is part of what we do in a live person relationship too. Like, we're looking at how are we changing together, and what am I taking from this, and what am I learning? I mean, that's emotional intelligence, right? That's self-reflection. If you're a
mm-hmm.
self-reflective person before death comes into your life, you're still a self-reflective person afterwards. So, of course, that's useful.
Right, right. So Megan, if people are interested in finding out more about you and your workshop and reading your blogs, and I know you give talks as well,
mm-hmm.
How can they do that? What's the best way for them to do that?
The easiest way to find all of the things that I'm giving out into the world, and all of the workshops and teaching circuits when those are available, are on the website, and it's refugeingrief.com. You can click on the blog. You can sign up for the weekly letter, which comes out every Sunday morning. Blog gets updated pretty regularly. The writing course, as you and I speak right now, we're in, what, mid-April. There's a course going on right now. Next probably won't open until midsummer sometime, but you can always check out more information there. And as I said, speaking engagements and teaching things will be up on the media page as they become available.
Great. Great. Well, keep doing what you're doing. I think it's really important and really needed.
Thank you.
So, and thank you so much for coming on the program this evening.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
I would love to have you back again sometime in the future.
Great. Absolutely.
All right. Okay, great. You have a good evening.
Thank you, Mara. You too.
Thanks. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we have lots more to come after the break, so don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Worried about memory loss? Dr. Ronald DeVere, certified neurologist and director of Alzheimer's disease and memory disorders in Lakeway, has been helping those with dementia and memory loss for over 12 years, specializing in the diagnosis, treatment, and counseling of those with memory loss and dementia. Dr. DeVere also has a book to reduce your worry and fear by knowing the fact. Memory Loss, Everything You Want to Know But Forget to Ask, available now on Amazon.com. Dr. Ronald DeVere, Alzheimer's Disease and Memory Disorders Center in Lakeway, and his book, Memory Loss, Everything You Want to Know But Forget to Ask. For more information or to schedule an appointment, call 512-261-7909.
Are you or a loved one a Medicare beneficiary? Help save you and Medicare money by stopping Medicare fraud. Fraud happens when Medicare is billed for services or supplies you never receive. There are three easy things you can do to fight fraud. Review your Medicare claims for accuracy, protect your personal information, and be on the lookout for suspicious activity. For more information or to report fraud, call Medicare at 1-800-MEDICARE or your local SHIP counselor at the Area Agency on Aging at 1-800-252-9240. Any guidance offered by Dr. Carpell is not intended to replace the advice of your own physician or mental health specialist. Neither Dr. Carpell, her sponsors, nor this station assumes responsibility for the misuse of any of the information given on this show.
And we're back. If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Mara Carpell in your golden years on Blog Talk Radio and on live stream and podcast at drmaracarpell.com. And now before I get on to talking about taming the inner troll and then going to our musician, I just want to talk a little bit about news for the show. We're getting closer to starting our own Roku station. We have videotaped several of the interviews of guests who have been live in the studio here in Austin, and we are still videotaping. Next week we have another guest live in the studio, and we've done some editing. So the next step will be the Roku channel, and I will let you know when that happens and how you can watch the interviews. Also, YouTube interviews. We have uploaded two new videos of teaser interviews with guests that have come into the show. We were doing that last fall, 3-minute interviews that have been uploaded to our YouTube page, Super Psychologist Dr. Mara Carpell. But they're also, if you don't want to go there, you could go straight to my website. They are also on my website, DrMaraCarpell.com, and just click on videos and you can watch those two videos that have been uploaded as well as the previous ones. And also on Facebook, Dr. Mara Carpell, Your Golden Years, I always post whenever there's something new going on with the program. And my blogs and Huffington Post, my two-part series on women finding our voice and power, especially in middle and later years, have both been published in Huffington Post, and you can find both of them on my website. Just click on blogs or click on publications, and you will find them. And also go to my Facebook page and just keep like my Facebook page. You'll know when I come out with my next blog on Huffington Post, probably even before I announce it right here. So that's the best thing to do. Or you can just search my name on Huffington Post. Okay. So now I am going to talk a little bit about taming the inner troll before our musician comes on the show. And you know, since I've been putting my blogs out into the public on Huffington Post, I have gotten to experience personally the phenomenon that is that of being trolled, quote, trolled, by what have come to be known as, quote, internet trolls. So, you know, this is a relatively new term and never really knew what it meant until it actually happened to me. It's an interesting kind of experience where people write sort of like nasty comments that are not really even related to what you are talking about. And Wikipedia defines this slang term, internet troll, as a person who sows discord on the internet by starting arguments or upsetting people, by posting inflammatory, extraneous, or off-topic messages in an online community with the deliberate intent of provoking readers into an emotional response, or of otherwise disrupting normal on-topic discussion, often for their own amusement. And so I'd like to expand that definition to also include people who may disagree with a point, so it may be on topic, may disagree with a point that someone makes, but they do this in a very disagreeable manner with put-downs and name-callings just for the sake of making the other person feel badly. And perhaps this has happened to you. It also seems to occur during conversations taking place on Facebook when a friend of a friend of a friend, who may not even be a friend but just somebody who connected with your friend's friend's friends on Facebook, they might insert an inflammatory remark toward you or someone on the thread of the discussion. So now I looked it up to find out, you know, where does this come from? Why do people do this? And there were actually studies done about this. There were two studies that were published in 2013 and 2014, pretty recent studies since this is really a pretty recent phenomenon. And they found that there are actually common personality traits of people who might be described as internet trolls. And the researchers in both studies found that people who demonstrate trolling behavior tend to be antisocial, and meaning that they don't have a conscience, and they tend to be similar to people or the same people who are bullies, teenagers or even adults who are bullies. And so trolling seems to be the same kind of bullying behavior. And the research found that so-called trolls tend to operate as agents of chaos on the internet. And they use emotional issues to cause people involved in these discussions to appear foolish or to appear like they're being overly emotional. And it's also been found that if someone falls into their trap of responding and getting upset because they've been trolled, the trolling behavior toward that person will intensify because this is the goal of the internet troll and it causes them amusement. And that's why there's a common bit of advice that has gone around the internet when being confronted by an internet troll, and that is do not feed the trolls. Okay, so very interesting about why some people might do this other than being antisocial. And in the 2013 study, it was found that trolls, internet trolls, often have very high unrealistic expectations of what it means to be successful, often higher than they themselves are able to attain. And this results in resentment of other people who appear to believe themselves to be successful but don't meet those standards that the troll has for what real success is. So they feel like they have to knock them down a few rungs. And the other thing to keep in mind when you're dealing with outer trolls, I'm going to talk about inner trolls, but the outer trolls, the internet trolls, are really not interested in having a productive discussion. Their interest consists of the following: deliberately angering people, breaking the normal flow of discussion that might be occurring, deliberately being annoying for the sake of being obnoxious, and most importantly, deliberately doing this to make themselves the main topic of interest or discussion. So after coming in contact with some internet trolls and then looking up the reasons why someone might behave this way, I had a thought that there is a striking similarity or some striking similarities between internet trolls and our own constant self-critical voice coming from our own ego. Deepak Chopra wrote in his book, The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success, the ego is not who you really are. The ego is your self-image. It is your social mask. It is the role you're playing. Your social mask thrives on approval. It wants control, and it is sustained by power, because it lives in fear. And then Dr. Wayne Dyer wrote, causing fear is a tactic of the ego. The ego idea has been with us ever since we began to think. It sends us false messages about our true nature. It leads us to make assumptions about what will make us happy, and we end up frustrated. And it pushes us to promote our self-importance while we yearn for a deeper and richer life experience. It causes us to fall into the void of self-absorption again and again, not knowing that we need only to shed the false idea of who we are. So in effect, our ego, ego is sort of like our own inner troll. So, you know, constantly goes after us when we think that we're doing well. Our ego will stick in a few criticisms. Who do you think you are? You're just an imposter. A lot of people feel like when they're moving along really well that people are going to find out that they really don't know what they're doing and they're imposters when they really do know what they're doing. And we hear this voice in our head telling us, you're no good at that. Who do you think you're fooling? Or, don't even try that. You're no good. So in some ways, our ego or our self-critic tends to be like the internet troll. The goal is just to have power, to knock us off our path and lead us away from the topic that we've been working on. You know, we might be working on our dream goal, our passion, then this critic comes along and kind of knocks us off the path. And its goal is to make us feel bad, to stop us, because it's fearful that maybe we will be successful or maybe we'll keep trying and prove that we're really not very good. So it tries to stop us before we even get there. And I think that, you know, if you think about it, somebody on the internet who's doing that to other people probably have that fear as well, that they can't do it, so they don't want to watch you try to be successful in whatever you're doing. So when Beverly Flaxington was on my program last year, she's the human behavior coach, she pointed out it's our own minds so often that defeat us. We say things to ourselves that tear ourselves down. The self-talk we use on ourselves absolutely drains us. Lack of confidence and low self-esteem is very typically an outgrowth of too much negative self-talk too often. And I would add that the chatter of our own ego also often consists of criticizing others who we feel don't meet our standards. And again, when we do that, it's because we have a fear that they will be successful or we're constantly comparing ourselves. So, you know, I don't know if this sounds familiar to you, because I think that many of us do that, or all of us at some point do that. And where does this come from? Well, author and publisher Louise Hay wrote, we tend to live our lives based on what we believe about others, our world, our capabilities, and our limits. Where do those beliefs come from? From what other people have told us. What if they're wrong? That's a good question. And since I often talk about how powerful it is to follow our dreams, no matter our age, one of the issues that I tend to notice is that we often allow the beliefs of others to become our own, especially those beliefs of no longer feeling relevant at our age. Maybe we feel like we're too old and nobody's going to listen to us, or that our dreams are no longer important or possible to fulfill. And the reality is that just because you believe it does not make it true. A belief is really just a thought that we think over and over again until we believe it. And some beliefs help us in our lives, but others only serve to make us feel bad about ourselves or to give up on our passion. And those latter beliefs, the ones that make us feel bad or give up on ourselves, cause us to have tremendous pain. So I would say that we can be more productive, we can be happier in our lives if we are willing to look at our own beliefs and to actually change them. So, you know, I know some people find it hard to believe that that we can change our beliefs, but we really can. We can look at our beliefs and we can question them. And just by questioning them, they lose their power. By asking yourself the question, is this really true? Is this something that I have made up, or is this really true? I think it immediately calls into question the validity of that belief. There's a really great author, Byron Katie, who has, she calls it the work. She has a system of questioning your beliefs so that they lose their power. What she says is that you can't just drop your beliefs just because you don't want to believe them anymore, but they tend to drop away when you question them and they don't stand up to your questioning. So, for example, one of the parts of the work is to ask yourself the question, you know, ask yourself what you really believe and be truly honest, and then ask yourself, is that really true? And, you know, usually we say, of course it's true. I believe it, so it's true. So the next question is that really, really true? I mean, are there other ways that we can look at it? There are other alternative ways of seeing the same thing. And could those possibly be true? So we might try flipping it around, try to flip that belief around to be the opposite of what we believe and ask ourselves, can that also be true? Does that have just as much of a chance of being true? And who would I be if I gave up that belief? How would this affect my life if I gave up that belief? So again, it doesn't mean that you just drop it, but by questioning it, it loses its power. So I did just receive a question on email asking that very thing, how can I get rid of my troll? And the answer to that question is one way of getting rid of that inner troll is by asking yourself if those beliefs are really true. And how can I proof that those beliefs are really true, and usually there really is no proof. And once we call into question or call in any doubt on a belief, it loses its power over us, and then we can start looking at alternative ways of seeing the same situation. And even when we do this, even when we seem to get rid of this inner troll and we're grooving along on the highway towards our dreams, the ego, like a troll, will throw in some negative chatter while, you know, asking us, you know, who do you think you are? Throwing in some negative beliefs about us when we thought that they were gone. So, again, just like the advice for people on the internet, don't feed the troll, we really need to remember that with our own inner troll, not to feed it. Don't keep feeding that, but just kind of, you know, be able to look at that objectively and say, oh, there's my, again, or there's my inner troll. I'm not going to believe what it's saying. Another tip comes from Don Miguel Ruiz. He's the author of the best-selling book, several best-selling books, but the one, his first one that's very well known, The Four Agreements. And Don Miguel Ruiz was on this program about 4 years ago, as a matter of fact. One of the four agreements is don't take anything personally. So he writes, don't take anything personally. Nothing others do is because of you. What others say and do is a projection of their own reality, their own dream. When you are immune to the opinions and actions of others, you won't be a victim of needless suffering. So that really works well for dealing with the internet troll, but I will add to this that this also applies to the chatter of our own inner troll. So don't take it personally when your own inner chatter says negative things about you. So being able to look at that and say that, you know, that's just that ego that we all have, and I'm not going to believe it. I'm not going to take it personally. It's just caused by things that I have heard in the environment, maybe parents or teachers or peers or commercials that tell us that we're not very good unless we're not complete unless we buy that product, or we are flawed seriously unless we buy that product. That's where it all comes from. That's where all that chatter comes from in our inner critic. And so if we can just say, I'm not going to take that personally, that's just a voice in my head. That's where the mindfulness training, the mindfulness meditation that I've talked about many times on the show and the guests have talked about many times on the show, being mindful is just being able to step back from your thoughts and not get hooked into them. So, you know, when you're doing a mindfulness meditation, your thoughts don't stop, but you just notice them and you label them rather than getting hooked into them. And when you do that, you're more able to see those thoughts that don't serve us, that are causing us pain, and we're able to be objective about it and start questioning it. So mindfulness meditation actually helps you to start dealing with this inner troll and getting them to start, or at least become more like just background noise rather than something that you get hooked into. So, you know, having control of your own thoughts may or may not be a concept that's new to you. But the overwhelming evidence is in, and it's clear that how we feel emotionally is very much caused by the thoughts that we think. And, you know, so these negative thoughts really do affect how we think, and they cause us to feel depressed. But the good news is that we each have the power to change our patterns of habitual negative thinking. And we can, by doing this, we also shift the chemicals in our own brains and our bodies. Often this can work as well or even better than medications like Prozac or Zoloft, antidepressant medications, just by changing our thought habits. And we can improve our health by doing this, and we can change our relationships and our entire life simply by making an adjustment to our thoughts and thereby adjusting our attitude. And Paul Tillich wrote, sometimes it happens that we receive the power to say yes to ourselves, that peace enters us whole, that self-hate and self-contempt disappear and that our self is reunited with itself, then we can say that grace has come upon us. So it's nice when that just happens, but sometimes we really have to work at it. And I know I've spoken about this before, but here's another tip for how to control that inner troll, that inner critic. And this is a tip that I read recently, but it's one that I've been using for a while in sessions with my clients. I've often said, what would you say to your best friend if you saw him or her talking to themselves in the same way that you're talking to yourself? And in fact, according to the latest research, this is extremely beneficial because it can be a way of stepping away from our own thoughts and being able to look at it more objectively. So a recent study that was led by Dr. Ethan Cross at the University of Michigan has added an interesting new twist to this way of changing our thoughts so that we change our feelings. So, you know, this twist is another way of having emotional distance from our thoughts so that we can be more aware of what we're thinking and we can have the power to change those thoughts that are not serving us well. Okay, so that's what I was talking about, being mindful of our thoughts, kind of stepping away and being a little bit more distant from the thought rather than being sucked into the thought and just believing it wholeheartedly and being able to, you know, look at it objectively and is that thought really real? So a way of doing that in this study, that was found in this study, was that if we refer to ourselves by our own name in our self-talk, so rather than by first person, such as I or me, this increases that self-distance and then gives us an easier, you know, ability to change our own thoughts and change how we feel. What they found was that this was especially helpful with people who suffer from social anxiety, although it was also helpful in any anxiety-provoking situation or when feeling depressed or angry about past events. Based on their research findings, the researchers proposed that using our own name and self-talk, along with words of encouragement and positive affirmations about our abilities to overcome the obstacles, may actually have a direct effect on our autonomic nervous system, which is where we have our fight or flight reaction, the stress reaction when we're in situations that we perceive as stressful. So it's a subtle linguistic shift, as Dr. Cross suggested. It's shifting from I to our own name. And that changes the way we feel and ultimately how we behave. So more specifically, what he found was that when people do this, they tend to be more supportive of themselves and more helpful in giving towards themselves and giving more helpful advice, similar to how they would advise their own best friend. And apparently, when using our own name, when speaking to ourselves, this gives us emotional distance to be able to do that. And they went further with the study, and they found that a brain scan image of people who address themselves by name during self-talk actually looked similar to those of people who are giving advice to their friends, while those who use personal pronouns like I or me don't. So it actually has the same effect as if you're giving advice to your best friend. And they concluded that using your own name elicits more wisdom and brings clarity into our thoughts about dealing with life events. So, for example, here's an example. So as I'm preparing to speak in front of a large group of people, I might be feeling nervous and so I might say to myself, Mara, it's normal to feel nervous when public speaking. Even some movie stars have butterflies before performing in front of people, but it's not a big deal. You've got this. You've spoken in front of groups of people before and nothing terrible happened. Just do your best in preparing the material ahead of time and then do some slow, deep breathing before you go on stage. And if it doesn't go well, it's not the end of the world for you, Mara. You'll learn from your mistakes and do better next time. You're intelligent and you know what you're talking about. Whatever happens, be calm and move on, Mara. So that would be an example, you know, replacing your name for and whatever it is that you're feeling anxious or upset about. And just remember, life can be difficult, and feeling badly doesn't make you a weak person, but it's really important to know that you have the power to change how you feel and that you don't have to be a victim of your own inner troll. All right. So on that note, we're going to take a break, and after we come back, we're going to be talking with musician Rochelle Rabone, who I had the pleasure of meeting recently and listening to her perform. And she's a musician, she's an early childhood educator, and a children's book author. And she'll be joining us on the phone from Dallas, Texas, to talk about her music and about teaching children about the sounds and music of Africa. And she might even sing a song for us. So don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
If you despise bra shopping in the stores, have a complimentary bra fitting at your home or office. It's so convenient. And with 13 styles, including a no-wire bra and 52 sizes A through H cup, Sonia Das, the bra lady, has the bra that's just right for you. What are you waiting for? Call to schedule your personal fitting today and find out what all the ladies love about essential body wear. Call 512-981-8788 or preview the products at haveaperkyday.com and have a perky day. Gravity.
Are you or a loved one a Medicare beneficiary? Help save you and Medicare money by stopping Medicare fraud. Fraud happens when Medicare is billed for services or supplies you never receive. There are three easy things you can do to fight fraud. Review your Medicare claims for accuracy, protect your personal information, and be on the lookout for suspicious activity. For more information or to report fraud, call Medicare at 1-800-MEDICARE or your local SHIP counselor at the Area Agency on Aging at 1-800-252-9240.
Worried about memory loss? Dr. Ronald DeVere, certified neurologist and director of Alzheimer's disease and memory disorders in Lakeway, has been helping those with dementia and memory loss for over 12 years, specializing in the diagnosis, treatment, and counseling of those with memory loss and dementia. Dr. DeVere also has a book to reduce your worry and fear by knowing the fact. Memory loss, everything you want to know but forget to ask. Available now on Amazon.com. Dr. Ronald DeVere, Alzheimer's disease and memory disorders center in Lakeway, and his book, Memory Loss, everything you want to know but forget to ask. For more information or to schedule an appointment, call 512-261-7909.
Any guidance offered by Dr. Carpell is not intended to replace the advice of your own physician or mental health specialist. Neither Dr. Carpell, her sponsors, nor this station assumes responsibility for the misuse of any of the information given on this show.
And we're back. If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Mara Carpell in your golden years on Blog Talk Radio and on live stream and podcast at drmaracarpell.com. And as I mentioned before the break, our next guest who is joining us on the phone is a musician who I had the pleasure of meeting recently at her own birthday party in Dallas last fall. And I got to hear her perform there. She's a musician, an early childhood educator, children's book author, and Rochelle Rabone joins us from Dallas this evening.
Hello.
Good evening, Rochelle. Are you
Hello,
there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, I'm here. I'm excited.
I just want to let you know that when we talk like this, there's a slight delay.
Oh, okay.
All right. I'm so happy to have you on the program this evening.
Thank you.
And it was a pleasure meeting you last fall.
Pleasure meeting you, too.
So Rochelle, maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about your background.
Okay, well, first of all, I just want to say that my talent of music comes from my dad, and my talent for writing comes from my mom. My dad was a musician. My mom was a librarian. I'm able to successfully combine both of these fields or industries and use them to help myself as well as other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I started, actually, my first recording, if you will, was when I was about 6 or 7. We were in New York at an arcade. I can't remember the name of the park. And I did a little version of Little Red Riding Hood or something like that. So that was my first, like, little record, if you will. But
uh-huh.
I've been involved in music probably since about, professionally since about 1969. I used to work starting at the age of 12. I started working in college auditoriums and nightclubs and things like that. Not by myself, but with my brothers and sisters. We used to put on shows. Also worked with the USO from 1969 to about 1972. I went on the road from 1974 to about 1980. And all this time I'm learning and relearning and finding out about the type of music that I really want to go into. I've done everything from rock and roll to country and western to world music. Currently I work for Big Thought, junior players, and communities and schools here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, as well as being an independent music professional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and you've written some books, haven't you?
I've written I've self-published two books. One is called Jingle Jingle, the Happy Helpful Bell, and it basically talks about bells from around the world. It's a children's book. And then the other book that I wrote is called Shapes Friends, and basically it's for pre-K and kinder age children. But it talks about not only shapes, the circle, the triangle, the square, and what I call the parallelepipedon. I say that because they can't say it, and they have fun trying to say it. There are four different shapes. There are four different colors. But the basic message of the book is, doesn't matter what color you are, doesn't matter what shape you are, we can always find something that we can do together.
Mm.
So it's
like
that's been
that.
Actually one of my best shows. The Shapes Friends show has been a very good show for me.
Mhm. Mhm. So now, are you teaching in the school district up there, or you travel from?
I do both. I actually work as what's called an after-school enrichment professional in after-school programs with the Louisville Independent School District in the afternoons.
Mm-hmm.
In the morning times, I present concerts at elementary schools, libraries, recreation centers, malls, and just places, public places where families and children are in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And you must get a big, must get a lot of positive feedback.
As a matter of fact, you never know if what you're doing is making an impact in any kind of way, which is when I finally realized that this is what I want to do, which is what I call kindertainment, which you're combining academics with entertainment and presenting it to children.
Mm-hmm.
I just decided that was the road for me, and this was back in 2001 when I actually realized that this is what I wanted to do. I enjoy working with kids, I enjoy music, and I enjoy reading. And so, I said, I combined these three elements, and it's been successful ever since, really, as far as the working with kids in the schools and libraries and things like that, and families as well. So yeah, and it would have been the road that I was going was more in a club atmosphere, trying to, you know, get the number one hit record. But I always kept on running into roadblocks. However, when I changed my mind, I kind of got frustrated and wanted to try something completely different, and which was the, you know, working in arts and education. That's what clicked for me. Matter of fact, people tell me all the time, I should have been a teacher.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
So Art said that the music that you sent, he was not able to download it so that we could play it.
Right.
But that you would be willing to sing a song for us, maybe a couple of minutes of a song.
Sure.
Okay.
Guitar. And I just want to let you know that I'm self-taught, but I did take classes in classical guitar and classes in voice and things like that. In college, so I ended up being pretty good. The name of the song that I'm going to play for you is called Ipinglela, and it is a song that was done by Miriam Makeba back in the 1960s. Ipinglela means "Show me the way home, brother," and it's a song about basically going home. It's sung at, it's a South African song. It's from the Zulu tribe. Ready?
Okay. Yeah.
Here we go.
That you play, or do you do all kinds of music?
I do all kinds of music, except hip-hop and rap. I've
okay.
done everything. Yeah, country and western. As a matter of fact, my most called-upon show is the South African music show. The second one is the Caribbean show, which we do basically folk music, retro music from the Caribbean, because we do historical-type pieces. And then the third show is the Jazz Remembered show, where I basically talk about the history of jazz all the way coming from Africa all the way to, and there's a dispute between New Orleans and I can't think of the name of the other city, but I do a jazz show as well.
Mm-hmm. And these are all for children.
Yes, and I also do the World Music Show, where basically we focus on teaching the kids about the continents through music. So I have music from at least one or two songs from each continent that I do, and with the exception of Antarctica, and I had to make up a song for that. So,
there aren't
yeah.
too many people there to write music.
Not at all. Not at all. Yeah, yeah. And I've enjoyed every step of the way. I'm always learning and growing doing this type of, because you never know what kids are going to say or how they're going to react. Never had a bad reaction. Always getting good feedback from the kids. And the kids are preschool. I mean, I even go into colleges and do concerts and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Always a learning experience.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, Rochelle, could you sing another one for us?
Actually, I have one that's queued up. Hopefully you'll be able to hear it. It's the very first song that I ever got on the airwaves. It was like a number one hit in Canada. And
uh-huh.
It's called This Is My Year. So I'll play a few bars for you.
Okay.
Can you hear it?
I can hear it.
That's a little clip from This Is My Year. I wrote that song back in probably 1976 as I was traveling
with
R&B band. I did that for about 10 years. I traveled what they call being on the road for about 10 years. And that was one of the songs we went into the studio and did. Like I said, it was a hit in Canada. Didn't do too well in the United States. And this was back in the disco days, too.
Yeah, it has that disco sound to it.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, Rochelle, if people are interested in finding out where you're playing, if they're up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, or if they're interested in hearing some of your music or purchasing some of your children's books, do you have a place for where they can go to? Is there any way to follow
you? Actually, there is. I have a website, but it's so long. What they could do is they could basically email me at my email address.
Okay.
I mean, it's really
What's
easy.
That?
It's gigsforrochelle2@gmail.com. So it's
okay.
G-I-S. Can you hear me?
G-I-S like Sam?
No, like gigs. Gigs, G-I-G-S.
Oh, G-I-G-S. Uh-huh.
The number 4.
Mm-hmm.
Rochelle.
Mm-hmm.
The number 2.
Mm-hmm.
@gmail.com.
Okay. So that's
yeah, and I can always answer their questions, or if they want to book me, that's cool too.
Okay.
Now, we do
the
State Fair of Texas and the Texas Book Festival every year since 2006, so we're always down in that area at least once a year.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm going to post your email address on my web post about this show later tonight or early tomorrow morning. So if people didn't get to write it down, they can just go there and find it on my website.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope I get to see you perform soon.
Well, when I get in that area, I will definitely let you and Art know.
Definitely let us know. Yeah.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you. And
you're welcome.
You had a good night.
You too. We'll be in touch.
Thanks. All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. All right, so we have come to the end of another show, and before we go off the air, I want to let you know what's coming up next week. Sunday, April 17th, we will be back live here in Austin, Texas, and at 5 p.m. Central Time, and we'll be joined by France Dubin right here live in the studio in Austin, and France is actually a native of France. And she's the owner of Bonjour Austin Voyages, guiding fun trips to Paris for independent women. She also teaches classes with travel tips to France from a native of Paris, France. And she teaches French language classes for adults through continuing education and individually. And France is going to join us to talk about how learning a new language helps to keep the brain young, and there's been a lot of research about that, so she's gonna talk about that. And then also we'll be joined by musician Alexa Chris, And Laura Galazunas reports in from the retirement paradise south of the border, Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and more. And if you want to hear tonight's program again and read the information from this show, go to my website, drmaricarpel.com. Also, be sure to follow me on Facebook for all the upcoming shows and information, and my blog, YouTube, Dr. Mara Carpel, Your Golden Years. And you can hear this show, this program, again in 5 minutes just by going directly to Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Your Golden Years. This evening's program was produced by Accomplice Entertainment, Postal Productions, and Psyched Up Productions, and sponsored by neurologist and memory specialist Dr. Ronald DeVere, by Sonia Das, the Bra Lady, and by Story House. And special thanks to my guests, Megan Devine and Rochelle Rabone. And of course, thank you, Art. Thank you all for listening. Have a peaceful night and inspiring week. And remember, youth has no age. Good night, everyone.
Mdundo.com, where the Lizzo Pendua comes home.
Any guidance offered by Dr. Carpel is not intended to replace the advice of your own physician or mental health specialist. Neither Dr. Carpel, her sponsors, nor this station assumes responsibility for the misuse of any of the information given on this show.